The Guardian.
I'm Richard Lee, and in today's books podcast, we're staring down the barrel of species extinction as environmental catastrophe rushes towards us all with the inevitability of an approaching asteroid somehow still lurking beyond our cultural horizons. Scientists and campaigners have moved on from sounding the alarm and started focusing on ways of averting disaster. For Tony Ryan, the answer is staring us in the face, or at least beaming down on us from up high. He tells us how solar power can put humanity back in sync with the sun. The children's author, Jill Lewis, has been exploring the relationship between man and beast with three novels putting birds, dolphins, and now bears centre stage. We ask whether fiction can help us to imagine a way out of impending doom. But first, we do the math with Tony Juniper, whose latest book tries to put a figure on what the natural world provides for free, and count the cost of environmental degradation with Eric Hirschfeld, whose compendium of the world's rarest birds lays out the peril our feathered friends are in. I started by asking Hirschfeld the difference between birds that are only rare and those that are under threat.
Well, it depends on how you look at it. If you are a twitcher, you will consider any bird which is not common in your country rare. But I'm looking more at a global scale and the birds which have small populations or are very threatened on the global scale.
What are the factors that are making so many birds under threat now?
Well, the main factor, I think, is man, definitely, because our activities in the nature, we are destroying habitats, changing the climate, and different activities we do, they can be subdivided into. We have the agriculture and the aquaculture, the farming of fish, which has a very high impact on many of the world's rarest birds, road building, fragmentation of forests, destruction of original plants and trees to replace with crops which we farm for our own well-being, for example.
And it's as simple as that. It's basically our fault.
Yeah, mostly. Then we have in a few cases there can be volcanoes on isolated islands which we cannot control, but on these isolated islands birds are found and they have developed very specific requirements and they cannot move to other places. In that case it is a natural type of extinction.
And sometimes it's a question of unintended consequences, isn't it? I'm thinking of the vultures in India, for example. Nobody set out to kill a bunch of vultures in India, but so what happened?
The vultures have disappeared rapidly with over 95% during the last two, three decades. And from being one of the most common birds in the world, they have become very, very rare. And they have a very important role to fulfill in the ecosystems, and they also have significance for our cultural practices. The vultures are also important for cleaning up from animals which have died, both wild animals and also domestic cattle. And if they are gone, the animals will be lying, and other groups of animals like dogs, for example, will benefit from this. But the dogs are not natural. They are released into the wild by us, so their populations explode.
This is one of the examples that you use in your book, Tony, as well. In What Has Nature Ever Done For Us, you assemble a vast catalogue of the different ways in which the natural world benefits human beings, one of which, of course, being the clean-up operation provided by those vultures.
Indeed, and in some cases we can place economic values on the kinds of jobs being done by creatures and different bits of ecosystems in sustaining human welfare. And the figure that was put on the loss of the vultures in terms of the cost to the Indian economy between 1993 and 2003 is a loss of $35 billion arising from public health costs, cultural impacts and other things. And really this is the main failure, I think, that we collectively suffer from in the world today, picking up on Eric's point about the destruction of habitats and the degradation of nature. The misconception we suffer from really goes along the lines of seeing a choice between economic growth and protecting nature. We see nature as being a drag on development in some cases, and in the British government right now we've had a theme running for the last few years whereby environmental protection and regulations to cut pollution are being held up as drags on competitiveness and ways in which we're holding our economy back. And so the reason I wrote What Has Nature Ever Done For Us is really to marshal the evidence to show that actually the complete opposite is the case, and that nature in fact is the biggest asset we have in sustaining economic development long into the future. And the more we degrade nature, the more we're imperiling the economy. That's my basic point, and the vulture story is a really good example of that.
Because, I mean, all the way through the book, you're trying to put a figure on this. You're trying to put numbers here. I mean, what's the kind of overall total? It's huge.
It's a huge number. Some bits defy quantification, and that's fine, and we need to protect nature, some elements of nature, because it's beautiful, and we can't put a value on it right now. But in some cases, we can actually start to calculate what nature is doing for economic development. And if you take the global figure, one estimate puts it at about double global GDP. That's the invisible bit of the economy that we're not measuring, but which we're liquidating and degrading in order to grow the other bit of the economy that we do measure, the bit called GDP. But the more we maximise GDP without paying attention to nature, the bigger the risks we're going to run longer term.
Guardian readers may already be familiar with the way forests remove CO2 from the atmosphere or the way that bees pollinate crops, but you also cite research which indicates it's not just the quantity of nature out there, it's also the quality, that the diversity is crucially important.
The diversity is crucial, and also the relationships that exist between different bits of the natural world. Bees is becoming quite well understood in terms of the contribution from pollination to global food security, and a figure of $190 billion per annum has been put on the jobs being done by bees and other pollinating insects. There's some other surprising things. For example, research looking into the economic contribution from insectivorous birds in different kinds of agriculture and forestry. And one great study from the Netherlands tells us about the effects of great tits in predating caterpillars during the springtime when damage is being done to the fruit crop. And one experiment that excluded birds from one bit of the orchard and encouraged them with nest boxes into the other bit of the orchard found a dramatic difference between the quality of fruit, with 50% more high-quality fruit coming from where the birds were active. And it seems to me a big failure for humankind at the moment, whereby we can measure the sale of chemicals into the economy. We can look at the contribution of companies like Bayer and Syngenta selling insecticides, but nobody's able to put a value yet on these birds going about their day-to-day business, but providing this huge contribution in terms of the productivity of farming. So I think that's something we need to fix quite quickly if we're going to reverse some of the trends that Eric's picking up on in his work.
And it's a simple matter of putting up some nest boxes in some trees.
Exactly. And, you know, this might seem quite surprising for people who are being told that they need to apply chemicals to their fruit orchards in the springtime. Actually, an alternative, or at least something that could be a complement to some chemical use, would be to encourage these songbirds in.
But as I say, it's not just a question of having birds there or not. It's about the different types of birds, the diversity. The research about Nile fever, I thought, was very striking.
Yes, the outbreak of West Nile virus in the United States in 2001 threw up some really interesting conclusions as to why some parts of the country were more affected than others. And some researchers looking at the patchy distribution of infections of West Nile virus found that the main thing that they could correlate with the difference in the levels of infection was wild bird diversity. And the reason for this was because the insect...
Not just numbers, actual diversity.
The actual diversity of the birds. And the reason for this is because the virus is spread by a mosquito, and that mosquito is a bird specialist. If you reduce the number of different kinds of birds for the mosquito to feed on, it starts to feed on other animals, people included, and that's why the virus was spread in areas where there were fewer birds, more amongst the human population. The birds were literally providing a buffer, diluting the disease and protecting us from infections.
So holding on to the rare birds that you collect in your book, Eric, is of vital importance. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of birders and many millions of bird enthusiasts around the world, so how have these dangerous situations been allowed to continue?
Well, it's just that we don't understand the things Tony are saying here, that nature has to be in balance, and that goes for diversity as well. If we take something away, the balance will be changed and things like this will happen. So it's very important to keep this biodiversity and start seeing nature as one whole entity. It's not just birds, it's not just insects or plants. They all come together to create this balance.
It's part of the problem, just a sense of scale, you know, the hugeness of the planet-wide effects, the slow creep of change on a planetary scale, the vastness of deep time. It's just difficult for people to understand.
It is, and one of the things we need to correct, of course, is the way in which we tend to look at everything through a very short-term horizon, the way in which the media works, the way in which economics works, the way in which politics work. All of these things drive us towards short-term gratification, votes at the next election, quarterly results, whether we can pay the bills this week. And one of the things we need to do is to reel back and take a wider and longer view. And for me, one of the ways in which we can do this is through a different approach to economics. If we can start to reflect these values of nature in how we're looking at the performance of countries and companies and the performance of the financial sector, things could be very different. And fortunately, people are beginning to look at that, to see that nature does have a tangible value. And if we can put that on the balance sheet, then we'll do things differently.
Isn't part of the risk in this kind of approach, the risk in trying to put a figure on the economic value of nature, that by measuring it in cash terms, you're kind of marketizing it? Isn't the market really part of the problem?
Well, there are big dangers in going down the economic route in terms of how we look at nature, but there's even bigger dangers in not going down that route as far as I can see. And I would say to the critics of looking at nature through an economic prism that this is not the only lens we need to look at it through. It is still beautiful. It is still of huge importance for human spiritual well-being. It is still hugely interesting from a scientific point of view. And on top of that, it has incalculable economic value as well. And I think if we can capture that, then we really will win the argument.
The science of this stuff is all perfectly clear, isn't it? I mean, there's climate change, ecological stress of various sorts. This is basically a problem of political will, isn't it?
In the end, it is about political will. In the UK right now, we have an interesting new committee reporting to Treasury ministers. It's called the Natural Capital Committee. And one of the jobs of that is to propose to ministers ways in which we can start to reflect in our annual assessment of economic performance some of these issues linked to the value of nature. It will be really interesting to see if George Osborne and these ministers pick up on this. At the moment, I have every reason to believe that they won't, but you never know. Maybe they will see that two and two do add up to four.
Here we are all going gung-ho for fracking. Right. I mean, here in the UK, it's
exactly, that's a political choice. The government is talking down renewable energy. It's trying to distance itself from climate change reduction targets, and at the same time, it's trying to promote fossil fuels. That's not only irrational, actually, it's also against the law in terms of what the 2008 Climate Change Act tells us in terms of getting on the trajectory to reduce emissions by 80% by 2050. We're not on that route, and the law says we should be, and I think politicians should pay attention to that fact.
So here we are, kind of in an emergency situation, with birds being devastated all around the world, with the UK heading in what seems to be the wrong direction. Why aren't you going into politics?
Well, I think there's a role for politicians in all of this, but there's also a role for voices outside. And one of the things that I found in being a candidate in 2010 is that you can get captured by party political momentum to the point where things are very difficult to do. And I think politics in the end these days is more about followership than it is about leadership. And I think if society changes, then politics will change too. So I think I'm better off outside than on the inside.
Tony Juniper's What Has Nature Ever Done For Us is published by Profile, while Eric Hirschfeld's The World's Rarest Birds is published by Princeton University Press. Jill Lewis is one of the authors who's managed to escape the festival site in Charlotte Square, setting up camp outside at Edinburgh Zoo. Here she reads the moment of encounter between man and beast, or at least boy and beast, from her latest novel, Moonbear.
I wriggled forward and peered down from our high rock. Moonlight reflected from the wide pools below the waterfall, the ripples spreading out in perfect circles of bright white light. The night scent of moth flowers drifted across the water. The whole forest was deep in sleep. Maybe Noi was wrong. Maybe it wouldn't come tonight. I stared into the folds of darkness on the far side of the river. In the deep shadows between the rocks and boulders, a darker shadow was stirring. I twisted a loose piece of forest vine through my fingers and watched. Despite the coolness of the night, my palms ran slick with sweat. I could feel the blood pumping through my hands. I swallowed hard. Below, some 50 paces away, the shadow moved. It formed, gained shape, and stepped out into the moonlight. I jabbed Noi in the ribs. Wake up! Noi's head jolted up. What? Shh, I said. It's here. It's here, now. Noi wiped the sleep from his face and leaned out. He looked down to the river and grabbed my arm. Where? There. The shadow rose up on its hind legs and sniffed the air. I held my breath. A bear. A huge bear. I'd never seen one before. It was taller than Pa, taller even than the chief. The crescent of white fur on its chest was bright against the dark fur of its body. It sniffed the air again, its small round ears twitching in our direction. It was a bear of the old stories. A moon bear, a spirit bear, crop eater, man killer, right here, right now.
So Jill, you arrived at the zoo this morning, didn't you? What have you seen so far?
Well, we've been around the penguins, koalas, chimpanzees, we've seen the hyrax, we've been around pretty much lots of things. Not enough time to do any writing, though.
Just not any time at all.
No time at all, but I've got a secret plan. I'm actually quite a slow writer. I probably write about 1,000 words a day, so to write very quickly at the zoo is quite difficult for me. So I've actually got the children to do the writing for me.
And what have they come up with?
But they've come up with brilliant things. Just in the space of a few minutes, they just come up with these brilliant poems, and they've drawn fantastic pictures all about endangered species, which is just
give
great.
Give us a poem then.
Okay, this is by a very young lad, but it's very simple. It's a little bit like a haiku, but even shorter than that. This is by Luca Thompson, and it simply says, "Pandas can chew on bamboo."
There you go.
And that's a brilliant one. I just love
nothing
it.
Nothing else needs to be said.
Nothing else.
Have you got another one for us?
Yes, we've got another one about pandas. Very popular at the moment, as Edinburgh has the only UK pandas. This one is more of a conservation issue, and children see things in a very real, very simplistic sense. They see the truth. This poem is called Theft, and I'll read you the last part of this poem. "A cub once roamed wild and free, but now kept in a zoo with concrete trees. Lands which had once been undiscovered are now bare of trees and left mud covered. There are not many panda bears left. People are taking down trees, and that is a theft."
And the poet moves into pink felt tip there.
Yes.
With capital letters and some underlining.
It does, big, and it's just great. And a wonderful picture of a panda.
The relationship between animals and humans is at the heart of your fiction, isn't it? I'm thinking of Callum and Iona protecting the ospreys in Skyhawk, or of Tam nursing the sick bear cub in Moon Bear. How have you seen people interacting with these animals here at the zoo? Is it different here at the zoo to the interactions in the wild?
I think there is a different interaction, but when you see some of the children see some of these species close up for the very first time. I heard one child seeing one of the rhinos saying they're like dinosaurs, and just watching them with sort of wide eyes, especially also in the wild when children get to experience an animal in its own natural environment. And you know, here in Scotland, it's absolutely rich in wildlife, with the ospreys, golden eagles, red squirrels, seals, dolphins, incredible wild species. That's a very special moment too.
Is fiction one of the ways in which urban kids, kids who only see wildlife on the way to school in the playground or whatever, is it fiction a way that urban kids can get a bit closer to nature?
It is. Here at the Edinburgh Zoo, they do have an education and community outreach where they go out and talk about the conservation work that they're doing. But I suppose it's my wish that children are lucky if they do have access to these conservation programmes, but there just aren't enough of them in schools across the country. And I think what would be fantastic is if every school could have a link with a local conservation area, and also with an overseas conservation area, so it become almost part of the school, a bit like a sort of twinning, so that conservation just becomes so embedded into our society, into our consciousness, that it's one of the things we put at the forefront of any decision making, whether or not it's urban growth or mining for resources or whatever. That's what would be great to see, and I don't think enough is being done to get environmental issues into schools.
With the world facing kind of environmental collapse, I mean, we've got population explosion, food crisis, global warming, we all know this is happening, but somehow we don't feel it. Is there responsibility for authors, and children's authors in particular, to deal with these kind of issues?
I think there is. I think there's responsibility for actually all adults to really highlight these issues, because just coming here to the zoo today, I've been talking to lots of the researchers about captive breeding programs and reintroducing animals back into the environment, or protecting animals in the environment. But it keeps going on that all these habitats are becoming degraded, or they're becoming very fragmented and losing the green corridors between them. And so I think there needs to be a vast change to actually understand these habitats and protect these habitats, because it's very difficult. There's no point in conserving animals within a captive population if you've lost the habitat. And again, this comes back very much to bringing this back into education as part of our society. And there are certainly some very encouraging changes that are happening. I mean, sometimes it all seems doom and gloom, but one of the biggest habitats facing threat is the seas, with overfishing and destruction of habitats. But scientists know that actually it's less than 1% of the oceans are preserved at the moment, but actually if they conserve 30% of the oceans, then we could have sustainable fishing forever. So things can be done. It's just a matter of governments making decisions to change that, and actually becoming part of what we need in society to push that forward, and not to ignore these issues, really.
But I mean, all this is stuff we already know. It's scientifically, technologically, we know what's going on, and politically there's a kind of absence of will, which it seems to be almost a kind of an emotional problem for society. Is that something where fiction can play a part?
I think fiction can play an enormous part. I mean, books are incredibly important for children. They expand horizons, live lives other than their own. And I'd like to think that my books are about conservation seen through a child's eyes. And I'd like to think that hopefully, well, they send a message of hope that one person, by influencing others, can make a real difference. So it isn't all doom and gloom, and there is hope for the future.
Jill Lewis's Moon Bear is published by Oxford University Press. Faced as we are with imminent ruin, hope is often hard to come by. One man who has it in sackfuls is Sheffield University professor Tony Ryan. According to him, the answer to our current problems lies in harnessing just a fraction of the sun's energy. Only the latest in a series of technological transitions which humanity has accomplished over the last 10,000 years.
The previous crisis, like the Elizabethan wood crisis, right? We weren't...
I love the idea of the Elizabethans having peak wood.
Yeah. They weren't really in quite the Anthropocene period that we are now. They hadn't really changed their environment that much. And we were still recycling all the carbon at that point.
So you mean when they actually ran out of trees, there was another option?
And the other option was to dig buried sunshine up from out of the ground, which nobody had taken before at scale.
So coal, the Industrial Revolution, petrol, and here we all are now.
Yeah, and here we all are now with, you know, the temperature rising and all that buried sunshine allowing us to escape our ecological niche.
I was struck by what you say in the book about the transition from hunter-gathering to farming, where you describe farming as being a necessary evil, one that condemned people to a life of toil and semi-misery, which kept average heights below pre-Neolithic levels until the 12th century. Is this idea that life before then was better the kind of foundation of the myth of the Golden Age?
Yeah, and the myth of the Golden Age really is a myth of the Golden Age, because for the majority of the people, it was miserable. There were a few golden ones, but they were paid for by stunted, underfed, miserable workers.
You can measure it in the height of their backbone, so that the people are literally taller in Neolithic times than they are after the invention of farming.
Yeah, for a couple of reasons. First is that they had a much more varied diet and less back-breaking work, literally back-breaking work.
Yeah, so this idea of a rural idyll is, in fact, just a kind of romanticism of the hard labour that these people are going under.
Well, yeah, and I guess because it makes for better books.
You're very dismissive of technology, which is much beloved of environmentalists and Guardian readers alike, organic farming, quoting the Nobel Prize-winning biologist Norman Borlaug's assertion that Western environmental campaigners are elitists who've never experienced the physical sensation of hunger. But what's wrong with organics?
Well, there's fundamentally nothing wrong with organic farming. So organic farming's great if you have a population on the earth of a billion people. It works. And it worked for a long, long time. But when we really started to transform the earth, making it more fertile with artificial fertilizer and growing more food to increase the population, we drove ourselves into a system where conventional organic farming just can't work. It can't feed that many people. Whilst it's good for the environment and it's great for people who shop in Waitrose, it ain't going to work in the slums of Delhi.
But you quote the Rodale Institute, which manages to match or outperform conventional farming, you say. What's the problem there?
The problem there is if you have 20 graduates per hectare, you are going to get fantastic yield. But we can't farm like that all over the world.
Not even if this is, you know, a crisis of epic proportions.
We'd have to put so many people back on the land, right? You know, at the beginning of the 19th century, 25% of the American population were agricultural workers. Today, it's approaching 1% of the population, the legal population.
Just the social transformation is unimaginable.
Yeah, and there isn't enough recycling of phosphorus, nitrogen and potassium in organic farming. So with conventional crops that have been designed for human inputs, they're not sufficiently in contact with the soil. They don't talk to the soil. They're essentially hydroponic, and they can't use manure and natural fertilizer. So we have to do something that looks like organic farming, but it needs to have genetically modified organisms. And we need to think about recovering every atom of nitrogen and phosphorus we can before we put inorganic fertilizer down.
So you need the good things from organic farming, but then plus some, plus a genetic modification, you say?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there's a lot to learn from the Rodale Institute, there's a lot to learn from organic farming, but at the same time, there's a lot to accept from technology.
Isn't there a problem with genetic modification in particular? Because it's at the moment controlled by global corporations who aren't really very interested in these crises. They're much, much more interested in keeping going the kind of monocultures, which is the problem with conventional farming.
Yeah, and there are vested interests with every technology, you know, whether it's energy technology, whether it's agricultural technology. We do need to take control away from the mega corporations, and I think we are going to have to do some monoculture. I mean, big cereal growing fields or paddy fields will be essential to feed so many people. If we don't want to grasp the problem of population control, we're going to have to deal with monoculture to provide calories.
Just because the crisis is so acute, there's so many people.
Yeah, and there's so many of us, and there's not that much land.
You're also fairly dismissive of renewables like biofuels, wind power and wave power, but why is the answer to all our problems to be found in solar energy?
Because if we can capture 1 hour of sunshine, we can power the whole of the Earth's economy for a year. And that's what we need to learn to do. It's the easy thing to do. Digging buried sunshine out the ground is dumb. Collecting sunlight in real time and using it in real time is really, really sensible.
So why aren't we doing it now? Why aren't we doing it already?
Well, back to those vested interests we talked about with respect to GM. You know, why would the energy companies want to put themselves out of business? They have a great business. They do not pay for the loss of amenity for future generations by digging that buried sunshine up. We really, really do need to get away from being able to dig things out of the ground thoughtlessly. Fracking for gas, okay? Great idea. Bring the gas price down. We burn more gas. We put more carbon dioxide in the air. Some methane leaks. It's 20 times worse than carbon dioxide. And what does it do? Makes us complacent. And we don't do the R&D. We don't do the thinking. We don't develop the legislation to transform ourselves back into a solar economy. Because we need to go backwards to go forwards.
So what kind of percentage are we at now in the UK with solar energy?
It really doesn't matter what number I give you, right? It could be 0.1%, it could be 1%, it could be 2%. It's certainly no more than that. It's a trivial amount. There's more wind, and wind's fundamentally solar power because it comes from the weather. Biofuels come from photosynthesis. Also solar power, but you add those all up and you might be getting to 5% of the UK's energy supply. And it needs to be 90% very soon and 100% eventually.
So is it a question of technology? What kind of state is the technology at for solar power?
Most of the technologies are there. Okay, it's not cheap enough. It's not at scale. There are some problems to crack. Storage is a big issue. So Gerald Ford has... The former US president is reputed to have said, solar power, it won't happen overnight, because he was a great comedian. And you have to overcome that intermittency problem. You have to store energy for when it's needed. And energy storage is where the problem is. So we have batteries, but they cost a lot of energy to make. We can store energy by liquefying gas, then using it to drive a turbine, converting it to electricity. But the real key, the absolute breakthrough technology that we do need is solar fuels. Transforming sunlight into stored energy by splitting water, using the hydrogen to convert carbon dioxide into a fuel, which is what happens in a plant, is something that we need to do synthetically. So I would see in the medium term getting this technology to work at the small scale. Then you could think of being off-grid and distributed by being able to generate electricity while the sun's shining and at the same time make methanol. So you make methanol using sunlight and catalysts, and then that methanol will then take you through the night, drive portable devices, all those things.
But this is algae growing in tanks, or this is chemical refineries on a small scale?
Well, and it's a bit of both. So depending on where you are, if you have lots of salt marsh, it could be algae making diesel. If you're in a block of flats, it could be panels on the roof that literally do a chemical reaction that sucks carbon dioxide out of the air and makes a liquid fuel.
But these are all technologies which are kind of understood, but just need a bit more development, aren't they?
Let's say there was a tax break So you didn't pay a tax on all the money you invested in renewable energy. All of a sudden, people would be investing. I think we need a change in policy and a change in emphasis. There are always unforeseen consequences of policy change. We need to be careful about where we drive research, but the development's key, and I'm not so sure that returning shareholder value on a quarterly basis can get us out of this. The market will not do it. It needs legislation, it needs public policy, and it needs public investment. I'd really like to pay more tax. That's politically toxic. Altruism seems to disappear in the ballot box, and I think that's what we have to overcome. The real solution is to stop growing the population, and the way to stop growing the population is to educate more people. I have got into trouble in the past by saying, you know, the more we educate women, the less the population will grow. But actually, I think in many parts of the world, what we need to do is we need to educate men in order to be able to educate women, and then we can drive the population down. But living within our energetic means, using the energy from the sun, leaving an earth that our grandchildren and their grandchildren might be able to live on, means that we need to consume less. And if we have to live in an economy like the economy we have, where we need continuous growth, then we need to spend more to consume less. You know, so we need to go down the kind of trophy handbag route of really well-made things that we're prepared to repair and use for decades, rather than the throw-it-away society we're in at the moment.
We need to trade up.
Yeah, I guess, kind of trade up quality. Yeah, absolutely.
Tony Ryan's Project Sunshine is published by Icon. If well-made goods is what you're after, you can trade up by finding us again tomorrow, when we'll be welcoming the Russian novelist Mikhail Shishkin, the Argentine writer Patricio Pron, and the solid-state physicist and science writer James Kakalios. You can find all our books podcasts from Edinburgh and beyond by searching for Guardian Books Podcast. Just listen online, follow us on SoundCloud, or subscribe via iTunes. From me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Ian Chambers, thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.